listening to National Rock Review.
Once again, boys and girls, this is Eric Morris, National Rock Review, coming to you with the best interviews ahead of the curve, and we make the future the present. I don't know what that means, but hell, it sounded good. All right, we have a special guest on the phone with me right now. He's up in the Great White North, and he's somebody that you might want to pay attention to, especially coming up in the next festival season. So, Mysterious Canadian, who do we have on the phone today?
This is Jeremy Weiderman, guitar player and backup vocalist for Monster Truck.
Excellent, excellent. So let's just cut to the chase. You guys have one EP out under your belts, and the big news is you guys are coming out with a brand new studio album in just a few weeks. What can you tell me about the album, the name, all that good stuff, and just roll with it, brother?
Before we get into that, we have two EPs out and a full length. So this will be our second full-length release, actually. And yeah, it's going good so far. You know, we've just gotten the first round of reviews in, and we're getting early feedback on all the singles that we've released, and we're just excited to finally be, you know, on the eve of getting ready to finally put it out. So, you know, it was a long 8-month process, and we couldn't be more excited to finally get it out into the world on February 19th.
And the name of it, is that Sitting Heavy, or is my memory really shot?
No. It is called Sitting Heavy.
Okay. And is this a full-length record, then, I take it?
It is, 11 tracks.
Oh, okay, cool. So you said that it took about 8 months to put it together. Is it all new material, then? What nuts and bolts can you tell us about it?
Definitely an all-new record. I'd say about half of it was worked on and kind of played live a little bit on the tail end of our Furiosity, our Furiosity run. Then we came home, you know, honed those songs down a bit more and wrote another batch of tunes and kind of put it all together over the course of last year. And got it wrapped up around August last year. And we've just been kind of, you know, setting up all the all the promo and press and everything since then. You know, there's that big gap that tends to happen around Christmas and New Year's.
Okay. Are you guys doing this all by yourselves, or are you putting this out on a label?
It's going to be released worldwide, Canada and the U.S. on Dynalone Records, and we just recently signed a licensing deal with Mascot in U.K. and Europe, and they're all kind of working as one big team, and we'll be releasing in all territories on the 19th of February.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I've heard really good things about both of those companies, so you're definitely in some pretty good hands. Walk me through the process. How does Monster Truck write a song? Is it one person that does pretty much everything and everybody chips in at the end, or are you guys a solid front, one kind of organism that makes it all together in one shot? How's it work for you guys?
Songs can come together any number of ways. You know, sometimes it is a somewhat of a singular effort by John, our singer, who will kind of put the whole song together at home and kind of show it to us, and we'll hone it down from there. But you know, we also will sit down with just nuts and bolts and kind of work on it as a group. It just kind of depends on the song and just depends on how far along the idea gets before we actually bring it to the jam space. So it's I say the majority of the real magic of the, you know, the best stuff that we've got on the record usually comes together with the four of us kind of all pitching in our ideas.
Okay. Now, here's the question that I normally would ask the vocalist, but since the guitarists are my favorite, well, for this interview anyway, what would be one of the more special songs coming off the album for you, just because you guys put so much time and effort into this stuff?
You know, the songs I put all the time and the effort into are the ones that take the most, aren't necessarily the ones that are my favorite. The one that really is kind of a favorite of mine is a song called New Soul, which is for a couple of reasons, really. It's like a lot of our songs, it's very guitar heavy, but it's just a really fun song to play live, and it's got a great little jam section in the middle, where we'll probably extend it out a little bit and have fun with it live. And then all the lead work, all the solo and lead work on that song kind of came together kind of almost off the cuff while I was working out and recording of the track, so it was kind of a thing that was one of those kind of came together reasonably easy, and I kind of went with the first instinct and idea, and that was a lot of fun, kind of just like writing the bulk of the solo and recording it all within like a half an hour time period, which sometimes it can take me months to nail down a proper solo or lead. And in this case, it was, you know, a short period of time, and maybe in one evening.
Oh, that's cool. With the album, what's the first single off the album that if somebody wants to check out Monster Truck Sound, what should they look for on YouTube or iTunes or wherever you guys are having music out right now?
The first single off the album is called Don't Tell Me How to Live. It's been bouncing around Canada since about November. It's currently number 3 in active rock in Canada, so it's doing what we hoped it would do so far, and we've just recently gone to radio in America with the song, and we're just starting to see some of the ads come in this week, actually. So there's a music video for it on YouTube, and it's pretty much all over the internet.
Ken, is there any place to pre-order the album, or are people going to have to wait until the official drop date?
The pre-order is on our website, ilovemonstertruck.com, and we've done some really cool things with the pre-order bundles. The album covers kind of a jean jacket themed front and back idea with a bunch of patches. Kind of, we did individual patches for each song. And so if you go onto the website, you can pre-order the record and get your own jean jacket with custom made with all the with the logo, the album title on the front, and all the different song titles kind of embroidered on the back and the patches.
Oh, that's kind of cool. So when you guys are going out, do you have any definite plans of when you're coming to the States next? Since hopefully, check local listings, it'll be getting warm here pretty soon. And everybody knows when May comes around, it's the loudest month in music. Do you guys have any plans to play festivals or shows or anything like that? Or is that still in the works?
A lot of that stuff's kind of nailed down. We're doing all the big rock festivals, Rock on the Range, Carolina Rebellion, and I can't remember the name of the other one. But we'll also be putting in a bunch of American tour dates, kind of to route us around those festivals, along with two shows that we just announced: one with Shinedown and one with Rob Zombie in North Dakota.
Oh wow! Didn't you guys tour not too long ago with Alice in Chains?
Yeah, we've done 3 separate tours with Alice in Chains.
Okay, that's cool. I have to ask, with you guys, you've been around since when? I want to say you've been together for a while, haven't you?
In 2009, so we're coming up on 7 years right now.
Okay, cool. Did you guys, are you able to still pick up things from the other bands that you tour around with, like the Alice in Chains or the Rob Zombies, or are you guys fairly comfortable enough with the routines and everything else that you've developed to, you know, that's cool, but this is how we do it kind of deal?
I think there's a little bit of both there. You know, we have a really strong foundation on what the kind of sound of the band is and the way we approach the music. But, you know, to completely close ourselves off and not be open to a bunch of inspiration from legendary artists like Alice in Chains or Slash, it would be crazy. So, you know, we're always picking up little things. And it's not always musically, too. It's, you know, we'll pick up just, you know, how they handle their business and, you know, all the different logistics that go into making a touring package successful. So, we're always, you know, eyes open and paying attention to everything that goes on around us, especially on those big tours.
That's cool. So basically, you're open-minded, and if you guys see something that works, you don't have any problem incorporating that into the routine. That's cool. Since we've kind of mentioned a few big names, we've unfortunately had a rather large string of music greats kind of leave us a little early, starting with the Scott Weilands of the world and kind of working their way through the Lemmys and the Bowies and even the Glenn Frys and, forgive me, even what the bassist for Rainbow just not too long ago. Do you have any feelings one way or the other, or any kind of stories with any of those artists that, you know, it kind of made it more personal for you guys hearing some of those losses?
Well, it's funny because the Lemmy one was horrible because, you know, it was, I guess, a situation where you knew his health was deteriorating. And, you know, we knew how big of an impact that would have on you know, everybody, you know, especially in the rock community. You know, I think he's extremely well-liked and respected, not just in the rock community, but in the general music community. So, you know, we hated to hear that. We're happy that we actually got to, you know, meet him at least once. It was a couple of years ago. We were opening for Slash. I don't remember. I think it was at the House of Blues in Cleveland, I think. And Lemmy showed up to do a song with Slash, and I was hanging out backstage and getting into the rider. So it was awesome to be able to say that we met him. And with that being said, it was weird in a way that the David Bowie one hit me a little more personally, even though I hadn't ever met Bowie, just because of how much time I spent as a kid listening to David Bowie records, and that was just kind of an influence down from my father. And it was super sad. It was actually really weird. I was listening to Ziggy Stardust the night before, just kind of coincidentally. Had a bunch of friends over, and I love that album. It's one of my favorite albums of all time. And then the next day, I heard about the news, and I was it affected me more than I think almost any musician passing has ever affected me. Maybe since Kurt Cobain, because I was such a grunge kid when I was a teenager. So, it's horrible to hear about all that stuff. And, you know, the Glenn Frey one was bad, too, because we have such a love and respect for the Eagles. And, you know, it's just, it is the way things go sometimes. And with all these artists, you know, from this golden era of classic rock and roll, all coming from the, you know, basically the 70s and the early 80s, you know, I think you're seeing a lot of these artists hitting that age where, you know, health becomes contender to an issue. So, you know, not looking forward to, you know, the next announcement, that's for sure.
Right. Since we've kind of hit on the topics of what kind of influenced you growing up, I have to ask, I've seen the sound of the vibe of you guys described as Southern blues coming from a Canadian act. How did the two worlds collide? What kind of helped your sound to the point where they would consider you Southern blues or more Dirty South rock and roll kind of sound? How did that come about?
That's just the reflection of a lot of what we were influenced by and listened to growing up. And, you know, the kind of unison that we were able to create with, you know, the modern sound, you know, whether it's kind of grunge or new rock or whatever influenced, kind of mixing that, you know, with the classic rock and Southern blues sound. That was just kind of over the course of just listening to so much music over so many years and, you know, really pinpointing down what it was about all those different kinds of music that you loved and finding a way to kind of make it into something else for, you know, our own purposes. So it was lucky and serendipitous and had a lot to do with the four specific members coming together at a certain period of time and really not taking it too seriously in the beginning and just kind of thinking about it as a bar band and something that we were going to do kind of on the side. And because everything clicked, it kind of took on a life of its own and became something else that we never really intended, which is a full-blown, you know, worldwide touring act.
So would that lead us into the story of how the monster truck moniker got picked? Was it just something, we're not going to be doing this for long, just pick something, let's go?
No, that was a more conscientious effort to have a t-shirt that we could put on the table that we knew would sell regardless of whether you knew who the band was. Because we pictured ourselves being in all these scenarios where we'd be putting our merch out with a bunch of other bands that were more popular than us when we were beginning. And we just knew we needed to move merchandise to help, you know, put gas in the tank and kind of make it so that we weren't, you know, going into debt or breaking even like we'd done in bands previous where, you know, money starts to become an issue. And it was one of the things that we kind of vowed from the beginning of this group was to never put our own money into the band because we were so frustrated and kind of like just we had gotten over, you know, ever having to go into debt because of music.
Right.
You know, we'd all been doing that in other bands for years, and it was just frustrating to be constantly, you know, not just putting, like, your heart and soul into something, but actually, like, your your money that you make at your other job is now being funneled out the other end because of a passion you have for playing music. And we just didn't think that was acceptable anymore. So the shirt really came from just, let's put some dollars in the bank while we're doing these shows. And then the slogan and the whole thing, don't fuck with the truck, just kind of caught on. And now it's just become kind of like a slogan that, you know, our fans shout at us during shows and have, you know, they're all wearing the merch. And it's a great thing because, you know, everyone knows that the touring has always been the lifeblood of your financial income. And to be able to say that about our merchandise is that, you know, that it will sell regardless is very strong.
Cool. Just another question or two here, and then I'll let you get back to the real world. You guys have been around the block a few times. You guys have toured with some pretty big names. I have to think that in all those shows, being out on the road that much, that there has to be a moment that's popped up, maybe more than once, where it's just surreal, where you think back on it, you just can't help but laugh at yourself, despite yourself, or at somebody else in the band, almost like a Spinal Tap moment. Is there one moment that you can think of that just makes you chuckle that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite memories, and it's kind of a proud and funny and favorite memory of being on the road was back in, I think 2 years ago, we were touring in the United States, and we were doing a tour, a three-week tour three-week tour with Alice in Chains, and then a three-week tour with Alter Bridge, back-to-back. And we just finished 5 weeks in Europe, so we hadn't been home for weeks, and we're on the road in the U.S. for the first time in a tour bus, and we had this new tour manager with us who was basically a dick, and we kind of just grew to hate him over the course of the first 3 weeks of the tour, to the point where, like, we were just getting ready to fire him. And we were going to basically take our stagehand and make him the tour manager because we just couldn't take this guy anymore. And we hit the midway point of the tour. We were about to switch over to Alter Bridge. We found out that the sound guy for it was the other way around. We were getting Alice in Chains second, so we found out that the sound guy for Alice in Chains, who's a great guy named Frank, was willing to do our sound for us. So we didn't need our tour manager sound guy anymore that we hated. So we basically were getting ready to fire him. We called up our management and said we were going to fire him, and they said, well, you can't because he just quit. So the feeling was obviously mutual. The fact that he quit was a great thing because then we didn't have to pay for his flight home because he made the decision to leave. So he leaves the tour, and we're in this tour bus, and we were already running lean. We afforded the tour bus. We didn't really have a crew other than one guy for the stage and one guy selling merch. So now we're traveling around the United States with the four band members and just two crew. And so a lot of people don't know, I guess, but tour buses typically hold 12 people. So now we're rolling for our first tour bus with only six of us and no real, you know, we're all adults, but no real parental figure without a tour manager. And it just kind of felt it was this really weird feeling of like, you know, we all felt like kids, the six of us, and we've got this tour bus at our disposal. We're traveling around the United States playing, opening for Alice in Chains. And it was just like this really kind of adventurous, you know, us against the world type feeling, you know. And, you know, we had all the room in the world on the bus to stretch out. And, you know, sometimes on a tour bus, 12 people, I've never even had to do it before because it's just something we've always tried to avoid because it's so hectic. So it's just really fun to run lean like that and be on this adventure across the country.
Okay. All right. With the last question, and then we'll go ahead and we'll wrap it up. Do you guys, being a Canadian band, do you find that there are stereotypes about you guys when you're playing in places like the States with the venues or with, you know, the radio stations or anybody that you have to deal with in the capacity? Or is everybody pretty cool with you guys being Canadians and it's not a real big issue anywhere?
No, you kind of nailed it earlier when you said we've got that Southern Rock sound, and it's really funny for us to be from Canada and have that sound. But it's helped us in not just America, but in Canada as well, where people just don't even assume that we're Canadian, so it doesn't come up. And if and when they do find out we're Canadian, they're, you know, shocked about the, you know, the way that the band sounds and that we're from there. So I can see there are Canadian stereotypes, and it can hold you back in some ways at radio and stuff because you just, there is a little bit of a stigma, but we haven't had to really deal with that as much, and it's kind of almost worked in our favor in that, you know, there's that juxtaposition of this, you know, Southern rock sounding Canadian rock band that kind of breaks the mold on what people traditionally know as coming from Canada. So again, I wouldn't say it's hurt us or the stereotype has really ever, you know, been put on us, because we've kind of broken the mold, so to speak, as far as, you know, where we're from and what we sound like.
Okay, so that makes me die to ask, and I apologize for this one ahead of time, but this will be the last one, I promise. What made you guys have more pride, to get the Juno Award or to be on NHL Hockey 2013?
It has to be the Juno Award. You know, I don't... Since, you know, kind of going through the gauntlet of award shows and the whole thing that goes along with it, I think it's almost been somewhat diminished over the years once you see all the politics that go into not just the Junos, but any award show is just naturally going to be this kind of seedy underbelly of you know, how things get decided. But that was a huge one for us because, you know, the Junos is basically all Canada has as far as a national, not the only thing, but probably the one that people are most familiar with. And it was just really cool from our family and friends kind of standpoint where, you know, once the shine of it wore off for us and we're back on the road just doing what we do, you know, working hard and trying to get the name out there, our parents, it's something our parents really, are, you know, have held on to. And, you know, really, it's something really very tangible for them. They, you know, see us on TV and they know what the Junos mean. And, you know, for any of us that had varying degrees of acceptance when we decided this profession early on when there was no money in it and no hope for success, it's really cool that it's, you know, come all that way. And there's this really obvious and tangible, you know, reflection of all the years we've put into working, you know, working as a band.
Good deal. Good deal. All right, brother. Thank you very much for giving National Rock Review a few minutes of your time. And we will definitely pay attention to you when you come down to the Detroit metro area and everywhere in between. So enjoy the upcoming months and the tour. And I'll be really excited to hear that album when it comes out.
Yeah, thank you very much, man.
All right. Thank you.